Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
My name is Michael Anthony Ingram, and tonight's very special guest is Alan King. Are you with me, Alan?
Yes. Hey.
All right. If you'd like to call in and ask Alan a question, the call-in number is 646-787-1631. Are you ready for this journey, Alan?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, number one, what is poetry? What is poetry, my friend?
Oh, man. So poetry, it's funny because there's so many ways to answer this, and no matter what the answer is, it's always going to be subjective.
Yes.
For me, poetry tends to be more visual, and I'm coming at it from a point of, like, narrative poetry. So, like, my dad is a storyteller. You know, he loves telling stories, and that's that's where I got the love of storytelling from. But I think, like, with poems allow you to tell stories, at least narrative poems allow you to tell stories in shorter spaces. And while you're telling these stories, you're doing a lot of showing. So I kind of feel like the imagery is what, you know, helps tell the story. And there's more emphasis on imagery than there is in the telling of it. You know, the showing. So, I'll also back up too and say that I'll try to flip what DJ Renegade said. So, someone once asked DJ Renegade, "What's the difference between a poem and a song?" And Renegade said that a song is a poem that can be sung, or a poem played to music. So, I think if you strip away the music and someone is able to speak the lyrics or whatever, I mean, arguably, I think that you can say that that's a poem.
Wow. Very nice. Well, let me ask this question, then. Why is it important? Why is poetry important?
Oh, man. So the best answer I can give is, it's not even my own response. I had to take this from a former professor of mine. So when I was in grad school, Kate Johnson did a session on creative nonfiction and poetry and what each art form or what each genre had to offer to the other. And so one of the coolest things that she said, and that always stuck with me, is that poetry is a shortcut to empathy. So again, because you have, you know, poems exist within a smaller space than prose. You know, the language, the pacing of a poem, you know, moves quick. And so I think, you know, poems can deliver stuff quicker than, say, a prose piece. And I think, too, you know, poems kind of get at the heart in a way that prose doesn't, or that other art forms don't. And I mean, the reason why I say that is because, you know, when people die, you know, you have poems read at a funeral, you have greeting cards, you know, which are kind of, you know, can be kind of poetic. When people are happy, you know, think about like a wedding, poems are read there. And so I think, you know, it's just that poetry, the form itself, has a way of getting at the heart quicker. But then, you know, some folks also argue, too, that poetry is kind of like on some elevated language, so it could you can say things in a way that gets at the heart as well. So like one of the things I, you know, when I go around visiting schools as part of Penn Faulkner's Writers in Schools program, the students will always ask me, "Well, how did you get into poetry?" And it's funny 'cause I will say I got into it because of the girls, that like I wanted to get girls or whatever. And for, you know, I mean, cliche, but for me at the time, and what I still think of is that there were things, or there was a way that poetry allowed me to say certain things that, you know, I couldn't say just speaking it, or, you know, that I haven't heard in a way, you know, read, haven't read in a way like reading prose. So.
All right. Well, at this particular juncture, give us an example of your work.
Okay, so this poem, I'm not even going to say what the moment is about. I think the poem is self-explanatory, but if there are questions, feel free to ask me, or if someone's listening in and have questions about what's going on in this poem, you know, please feel free to call in and ask about it. But this poem is called Beacon. An intern asks, "Aren't you scared?" And you remember the hospital clerk saying, "What you're doing is courageous. You do what you have to for your wife, whose life is leashed to a box, cleaning her blood before spooling it back into her body. It does what it has to because her kidneys can't. And weren't they courageous standing their ground before lupus took them out? Its gluttony left you scratching your head, lost in this new life, the one that marks you donor and your wife recipient, the one where the transplant center is another turf to navigate. This life, where words like renal failure and nephrectomy seizing your new tongue. You watch your wife sleep while the machine chimes and beeps, remembering the intern's question. Of course, there were moments that gobbled your bravery to a morsel. The emergency room visits, lupus nearly taking her out. And isn't she the courageous one? How she welcomes each day, even those where grief is the overcast sky. Those moments when the only light is her heroic heart blazing these dark streets, winding beyond the mysterious and unknown." That's it.
Beautiful and powerful.
Thank you.
How does a poem begin for you, with an idea, a form, or an image?
Image. So, like,
Tell
I
me more.
am very, very visual person. So, you know, when I talk with folks, they'll say, "Oh, a poem." When a poem for them, when it comes to them, it comes as like a line, a couple lines, or something like that. And for me, it's that's happened maybe a few times, but it's rare. For me, a poem will begin with like a series of images, and actually, it'll be, you know, like I would be somewhere, and maybe it's the music, whatever. But there's always some sort of trigger, you know, something that triggers a moment, a memory, or something. And so a poem for me will come in like slivers of a memory. And then, you know, my process is sometimes, you know, when I first started writing, I would try to write everything down and retell it. But lately, my process, you know, has been to just let it kind of play itself out. And when it is time for me to write, or when I feel like I have enough to start putting out on paper, you know, I don't worry about what I remember or what I forget. I always feel like whatever I remember when it's time to put down is, you know, what's meant for me to put on the paper. And what I forgot, you know, I kind of look at it as like my mind kind of self-selecting, you know, what details are not important or what details are. But yeah, for me, it's always an image or a sliver of a moment. And initially, initially I'm writing it just to record it, but then the next step is like, okay, well, I have this moment, I have this memory. How do I want to use it? What message am I trying to get across? And so then in that sense, the memory or the moment that I'm reliving or recording becomes a vehicle for like a larger message.
Well, please share another piece of your work.
Okay, thank you. So since I read Beacon, I'm going to read the poem that follows it. So this is Into the Light. You're a floor below me, healing in your room. Both of us soar from the divine puppetry of science. God pulling the surgeon's strings, sliding the kidney from inside me, routing it to its new body in Connecticut. And wasn't he present in the hand's deft dance and how hope lights the operating room like a stage? Your new kidney ready for its debut inside you, having traveled in a freight of prayers, 17 hours from Minneapolis to D.C. Didn't our road here seem even longer, not being a direct match? The hiccup in lab results, us hurling our names into an exchange pool deep with uncertainty. And here we are, in our beds, an elevator ride from each other. This moment, like the 90-degree day beyond our windows, the cloudless sky, shadows receding in the sunlight. That's it.
You know, those poems were about surgery plus other things. As you think about the entire body of your work, what are some of the predominant themes that come to mind?
Well, so when I think about the work, I have two books out, and then what I'm reading from is, it's not a complete manuscript, but it will most likely go into whatever the third book is. So I always look at where I was, like where I was at the point in my life when the first two books were published and then the stuff that I'm writing now. And so with Drift, when I was writing Drift, or in the process of writing Drift, what came up a lot was like longing and relationships and actually past relationships. And it was because at the time I was single, I didn't meet my wife until probably about the tail end of it, which is funny because she pops up in the last poem of that collection, last poem in Drift. And in Point Blank, my wife is all over the manuscript because, I was married. You know, we were married when I was working on the book, and we weren't parents at the time. So, just focused more on, maybe a little bit of me looking back, but also just celebrating my wife in different ways. And what's funny about that was when we first started dating and she read the manuscript for Drift, she was like, oh, you got all these other women in this, and this new one, I better be all over it. So she got her wish. She's all over Point Blank. But with the new stuff, I won't even say it's new. It's stuff that's in this, what's trying to be a manuscript. We're parents now, and so there are some parenting poems in it. I always tell folks that as soon as we became parents, this like cloud of judgment, in the public and even within our families, I feel it. Every time I'm out with my daughter, I feel, even though I may not see it, I feel that there are a set of eyes watching me, watching how we are when we're out and about, and they're looking at what she's wearing, and, if it's chilly and she has a light coat on, I'm sure I wouldn't be hard-pressed to find someone like, you know, wondering why she's wearing the jacket that she's wearing. But it's a feeling that wasn't there for me until I became a parent. And so now, you know, that comes up in the manuscript. And then just other aspects of parenting comes up in this. So I'm actually excited about the new stuff that I'm writing, excited about how my daughter appears in the new work, as well as my wife. And one of the things that my wife said that I wasn't aware of was that she said she's starting to see a lot more aspects of faith coming up in the new work. And it's faith, you know, as a way of like what I lean back on. You know, I'm not bopping people over the head. I'm not trying to convert anybody. It's just, you know, like the presence of faith, you know, comes up in the work. So like in the two poems I read, you know, we leaned a lot on prayer.
Yes.
You know, because with the surgery and then just how things would be after that. And so it's, you know, it makes sense that that is also dominant in the work.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a brief break and we'll be right back. We are back. My name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with the incredible Alan King. Alan, question for you.
Sure.
All right. Do you sit and think through every word of every stanza, or do you write freely and allow the words to flow?
I'll say when I first started, I thought through every word, and now I tend to write more freely, and it's probably because of like the poets I read. So like Tim Siebel's, when I read his poems, they have a conversational style about them that I like. And there's still, you know, there's still decisions being made on the page. So like, even though my work is conversational, there's still, you know, if I see opportunities to play up certain literary devices, I do that within the work. But I think initially it's just getting the poem out and then going back and constructing it and, you know, looking for the opportunities that I didn't see when I was initially putting it down.
All right. You know, all great writers have great writing influences, and you've mentioned a poet. Who are some of yours and what makes them great in your eyes?
Oh, man. So, like I said before, Tim Siebel, he's the former poet laureate for Virginia. And he, when I first read his work, because I was pretty well read in poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not read anyone like him. Like, his poems are funny. His poems are, even the political ones, even the ones where he's like, you know, writing about race. And it's a technique he uses called the tickle punch technique. And, you know, it's where he tricks the reader into thinking that the poem that they're reading is a safe one. and they can put their guard down, and then boom, he hits you, and then you, when you put your guard up, he kind of tickles you again, and it's like, hey, not so bad. You drop your guard, and bam, and he does that throughout a whole poem. He'll do that throughout a whole collection, and if you see him or hear him read, you know, he's a great, he's really great at reading his work. You know, he does that. So he's definitely an influence. The current poet laureate for the U.S., Joy Harjo, is another influence. Like, I'm going through her one of her selected collected. She has some horses. But with Joy, Tim and Joy were my teachers in grad school.
Oh, wow.
And, and they both did the blurbs on the back of Point Blank because, when I was reaching out for blurbs, I thought that they would best be able to write about it because they were very influential in helping to help me shape the manuscript, which became the book. So with them, having, learned under them, studied under them, I guess it's like with anybody that I've workshopped with before, like their voices stay with me. So even when I'm writing or when I'm editing, like I can hear Joy in my head. You know, and Joy's thing was parallel time. So, yeah, you're writing a poem in this moment, but what's going on in the parallel time? Or is there a parallel moment to this? You know, and so that's her thing. Tim is like, he wants me to, Tim thinks about writing poems as like playing a solo. And so if I'm working on a poem and I think I got it where it is, Tim's like, are you really sure that you've maxed every opportunity out on the page? So definitely Tim Siebel's, Joy Harjo, then there's Patricia Smith. I'll even say Cornelius Eady,
mm-hmm.
because of his way of using voices. And I'm thinking, my mind is automatically going to his collection, Brutal Imagination.
Mm-hmm.
He did the voice of the imagined black men that were blamed by for killing the kids. A time when like two white women drowned their kids and blamed it on a fictitious black character. So he writes from the perspective of those fictitious black men. So Cornelius Eady, who else? And the person who I really, really love is Jan Beatty. And she has her style of poetry, like she's a narrative poet, at least I consider her a narrative poet, but she, I mean, her stuff always knocks the wind out of me. Like I'm never ready for her poems, even though I think I am, but when I read them, like just where they take me, I'm just like, ooh, like I'm hurting at the end of her pieces. And I first heard her read at a Split This Rock poetry festival, and I've just been following her work ever since. And just off of what I can recall right now, those are some folks that are really doing it for me right now in poetry.
All right. Well, share another piece of your work.
Okay. So earlier you had asked me, like, what are some dominant themes, and my wife went through the manuscript and was like, man, you love to eat. And that is true. I love food. So,
yeah, I know that feeling.
Oh, I love it. So this poem I'm going to read is, I always have to give a brief, background story about it. So my wife and I, we commute to and from work, and she loves to talk. And we have an hour-long commute. And so when I go to pick her up, I'll say, hey, how was your day? And she goes off, just everything. And, the remaining 15 minutes, so this is, again, an hour-long commute, remaining 15 minutes, she said, oh, I'm sorry, babe, how was your day? And so my way of dealing with it, because, love her so much, my way of it not being annoying is like I naturally now just go into autopilot. So I'm just kind of like, oh, okay, for real? Oh, and the autopilot is worse when I'm hungry.
Right.
And so the poem I'm going to read is a response. She wants to ask me, where do I go when I'm here but not here. So this is it. I wanted bananas, a bunch of them, spooned body to body like small yellow kayaks. So I missed what you said about the war in Libya. When you say Gaddafi, I think of how they spoil if they sit too long on their wicker thrones. We're in my car, listening to WTOP. We pass the Spanish market that calls what I love plátanos. Just saying plata, my tongue snaps like the slingshot's elastic strip hurling A's like stones. You complain about the weak radio signal. I could nod and punctuate your frustrations with hums as if I'm listening, as if my head weren't full of hunger's SOS. I could pretend that the radio static is annoying, as if the sizzling sound it makes doesn't have me thinking of sweet, chunky rumba slices frying in my mother's skillet, or plantains boiled whole with dashing dumplings and potatoes to eat with saltfish in coconut bake, plates and plates of large bananas, edible boomerangs, nature's golden sugar-filled tusk, the moon's waning frown or waxing smile. That's it.
I could see it. I could see it. You're talking about being a visual poet. I can see it. I can see it. And it makes me hungry. I should share that with you. It makes me hungry. That was excellent, man. Excellent, excellent.
Thank you. Tell us
about your process. Is it pen and paper, computers, notebooks? How do you write?
So back in the day when I first started, I would try to walk around with a notebook, physical notebook and pen, and would end up getting no writing done because for some reason, me carrying around a pen and pad, this is the expectation of writing chases away like any inspiration I have. So now I think like with all the digital tools that we have, like I'm more of a digital writer. So like I have Evernote on my phone, the Evernote app, and I have like other note-taking apps. And so, you know, the cool thing about it is that it's always with me, but there's no expectation that something has to be written. And it's just that, you know, stuff come to me, I usually whip my phone out and we'll go into Evernote and just start banging it out, you know, on the phone. And then maybe if I get home or whatever, I can go to that note on the computer and like kind of flesh it out. And it's, you know, I mean, that's just my process because I remember before, you know, like I'm never at a desk, never near where I need a pencil or a pen or whatever. And so just to give you some idea, you know, sometimes there've been moments when things have come to me and I'm in the line at the CVS pharmacy waiting to pick up a prescription for my wife. And, you know, someone would hit me then, and boom, like you see me in the line on my phone just going. Or I'm out with, you know, my best friend, Derek Weston Brown, and we'll be out hanging somewhere, and something will hit, and I'll have my phone out. So it's, I mean, for me, I just love that process. I love gadgets, and I love apps, and so that's kind of where I kind of see how my process has evolved. You know.
Right. Well, share another piece of your work.
Okay. So, yeah, I'll share another poem about food.
Okay.
So this one is from my parents, and it's called The Hostess. She starts with oil. She simmers garlic before adding curry. Got to cook it real good, she says, or else it'll mess up your stomach. Mom adds sugar to blacken the already dark tint left on what pops and sizzles, what mixes in the meat steaming in a bubbling bath of cumin, turmeric, and cayenne pepper. Mom doesn't cook curry a lot. just on days when Dad comes home tired, when each day is an opponent that leaves him bruised like the bags of fruit he brings her. One time, Mom wrapped her arms around his neck, and Dad said, "You only love me for my mangoes." They both laughed when Mom said, "You got to bring mangoes home more often." He'd tell Mom about the days when his drill burned out, when his truck got a flat in the rain or didn't start, when days seemed to plot against him as if he was a fighter past his prime, unwilling to lie down and throw the match. And there's Mom's curry lingering in every room, opening the house for his return. Dad enters her scent that calls him to the kitchen, ready to put back what the ring takes out of him. That's it.
You know, as you think again about your body of work, all poets have several words that come up over and over again, words or sentences that they just can't help but use in their work. What are three of your absolute favorite words to use?
I can't think of them. I can't think three words. Food. Food terms.
Okay.
Food terms come up a lot in the work. And the funny thing is, I'm not hungry when I'm writing these poems, so I don't know. But definitely food terms. And the reason why food comes up a lot is not only do I like to eat, but I love to cook. So a lot of the Caribbean dishes that I know how to cook now, it's, you know, dishes I've learned from hanging with my mom in the kitchen. And, you know, I mean, there's a few dishes I do now where I'm just simply pulling from memory. You know, every measurement, you know, everything is, you know, and it's what my mom taught me. And you know, just to kind of add another dimension to that, another reason why I loved hanging out with my mom in the kitchen is because my mom doesn't read poetry. I mean, the only poetry book she read was like my first one, and you know, because she was just really proud of me, but she doesn't really read poetry. So when we had our moments in the kitchen, that was when I would like introduce her to like different kind of poets that I like. So I would actually bring poetry books in the kitchen, and while she was cooking, you know, and while I was learning from her, I would read like a few poems to her. And that was her way of being introduced to it.
Do you think that you were meant to be a poet?
So it's funny. I think the best way for me to answer that is, you know, some people ask if I chase poetry or if poetry chased me. And I think it's a little bit of both. Like, I think, you know, I had a bad encounter with poetry when I was in fourth grade. And so I was like, oh, I hate poetry. But then, you know, there were other moments in my life where I felt like I couldn't escape it. Like when I was in middle school, the teacher did a unit on poetry. I thought it was cool. I wrote a few poems, and then I was like, okay, I think I'm done with it. And then it came back when I was in high school. And it came back because the first poet, the first live, living, breathing poet I met was my English teacher. And, you know, senior year high school, he would not only teach us the different rhyme schemes, but he would also bring in his own poems. And so, you know, to try out with us. And so, you know, I think there are like so many moments in my life where I was like, okay, you know, I did poetry. And at the times I wasn't thinking about writing a book. I wasn't thinking about blowing up. I wasn't thinking about any of that stuff. I was just having fun with it. And then, you know, I'd say, okay, I guess I'm done with it. And then there would be, like, something else in my life that would bring me back to it. And so I don't know. I don't know what you would call it. I don't know if you would say that I was meant to be a poet. You know, I don't know. I just know that I guess my way of answering it is that I look at these different instances where poetry kept popping up as like, you know, maybe poetry following me, or maybe poetry telling me I can't get rid of it that easily.
All right. Share another piece of your work, please.
Okay. So I will, looking for this one poem. Oh, here it is. So it's a poem from my brother-in-law. I don't even know if you read the poem. I posted it on Instagram where he is, and I don't know. I don't know if he read it, but this is for him, and it came out of a conversation we had, and the poem is self-explanatory. So, but it opens with an epigraph. So the epigraph is a quote. It says, "When you run the marathon, you run against the distance, not against the other runners and not against the time." And that's a quote from Haile Gebrselassie.
Yes.
And the title of the poem is called Stride, and it's from my brother-in-law, Tolu. "I don't remember when it happened," he says. "All I know is one day Eli put himself to bed. You watch your brother-in-law with an envy you haven't felt since you were 16, when you learned your little brother lost his virginity before you. You remember feeling like he crossed the finish line before you started the race. Your brother, far beyond the horizon of that milestone. And you're just as far behind your brother-in-law, wishing you could breeze the distance to him in this full marathon called parenting. Even now, he's disappearing from your field of vision as he goes on about his kids sleeping in their rooms, while your three-year-old holds your bedtime hostage, demanding another story, crying and jumping when you say it's sleepy time. She's taken over your California king, doing mixed martial arts in her sleep, the toddler with the elbow and knee strikes, with the jabs and overhand punches, your bonnet-donning pajama kid. Test your limits when each sleepless night leaves you like a runner at mile 20, hunched over, gasping, glinting with sweat, muscles blazing, but this is just the starting line of a long-distance test of patience. It's how your parents must have felt, especially your poor dad. It couldn't have been easy being the only foreigner at his job, trading barbs with the other black electricians who riffed on his accent and the extra stuff he got from the white foreman. It couldn't have been easy trying to keep it together, verbally sparring with guys he was smarter than, then coming home to your attitude. How many times you almost broke his patience when he nearly came out of himself to give you a piece of his mind. Luckily, he never broke his stride. If you learn anything from him, it's enjoying small victories, even in the moments that seem hard. It's the lesson your brother-in-law takes in stride. His stories about his kids is his way of coaching you to keep running. That's it."
Powerful work.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. And again, I'm Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Alan King. Our number is 646-787-1631. You know, Alan, we live in a very complicated world, I believe. And I'm wondering, what do you see as the role of a poet in modern-day society?
So I definitely see the poets, excuse me, as the archivist. So, like, documenting various moments in history. I also see the poet as sparking, you know, conversations amongst people. You know, the poet, I kind of see the poet. I won't say the poet is the instigator, but the poet kind of gets folks agitated and ready to create some sort of, ready to be active for some sort of change. And I also see the poet as, I also see the poet as, you know, the one sharing the vision of, like, what's possible. You know, I think the role of the poet, and this, again, it's all subjective, but for me, I think a poet's role is to show what's possible and to ignite in people to want to be active, to reach that possibility. And I think the role of the poet is to also document those different movements or different moments of time.
Right. You know, one question that I wonder about is that, does knowing that your poems are published, and you've published two books and numerous poems in different journals, does knowing that your poems are published and out there in the world validate your being a poet, or are you content knowing they're out of your system?
I like that question.
Well, thank you. That's why they pay me the big bucks, man.
So I'll say it's a little bit of both. You know, if I'm answering this honestly, it's a little bit of both, because I am happy that the poem is out of me, that it's out in the world. In terms of validation, like, I kind of feel like I was validated before I was published. And the reason why I say that is because this was back probably like in the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, when my validation came, like, when I was on the open mics and I finished doing a poem, and as I was leaving the stage, an older poet would pull me aside and say, "Hey, can I take a look at that poem?" And, you know, them marking up the poem, you know, and showing me ways to make it stronger. And the reason why for me that was validating is because, you know, even though they marked up the poem, and of course they would ask, like, "Hey, do you mind if I," and I would say, "Sure." But the reason why that was validating for me is because, you know, in order for them to put in the time to even look at the work and mark it up and give me suggestions on how to make it stronger, they had to have heard, like, the possibility of something in it, the potential in it that I probably wasn't hitting at the time. So that and workshopping with them was definitely validating, but I'd be lying if I said that seeing my work in print wasn't validating. I think it's another form of I'll switch words. I won't even say validating for this. I'll say that it's another form of fulfillment, you know, because a lot of what we do, you know, at least from what I see and from other poets that I talk to, other writers that I talk to, you know, you're doing this work alone. You know, I don't know of any poets that have, like, a hype man behind them looking over their shoulder like, "Yeah, it's fire." I don't know of any poet that has somebody in that space. It's usually just you and the work. And so to get to a point where you think it's ready to be put out there and for it to be received by being published and, you know, knowing that it's going to be read somewhere, I think it's a different kind of fulfillment, you know, and it feels good.
All right. Share another piece of your work, please.
Okay. So this next poem I'm going to read, my wife loves this poem, and I think it's ironic that she likes it. That's all I'm going to say. And I think the poem itself will kind of show you why I think it's ironic or where I think the irony is. So this is called Gluttony. Combing the bargain bin, a woman who's not your wife brushes beside you asking if the Roy Hargrove CD you're holding is any good. She's close enough for you to smell her ginger patchouli body wash, the angle she gives you in her leather bomber jacket, the one unzipped showing a white tee retracing her athletic stomach and arms, the jacket with its collar flared, makes her a bright blossom booming its honeydew-scented tune along her neckline. And your father's voice from 2 decades before warns you about gorging on everything you see. You were 16 the first time he told you, when your hunger hovered like that summer at Myrtle Beach, sister strutting the boardwalk beneath a honey barbecue sun whose sweet light made each of them a long stretch of marinade, a chromatic scale of flavors along which your tongue was burning to play. And isn't temptation always lurking, eager to hold our common sense hostage? You tell the flower woman you marry after she points to a flyer for a Roots show and says y'all should go. When she says, "Are you happy?" you remember a brother once asking how you could love one woman when the world's a buffet. The possibilities of pleasure laid out like jumbo crab cakes, lasagna rolls, and buffalo wings. What's gluttony if not a symptom of our own hunger consuming us? Wasn't Jack as careless selling his sustenance for a handful of beans? You remember the story of the stalk that almost made him a hungry giant's grub. You still hear the pastor preaching about gluttons wearing the rags of drowsiness, which is how your wife found you, stumbling through the days. Your life before her was a stringless violin, a dark garden of wilted sunflowers, a camper trailer rusting against a moldy brick wall. You were once a city of power lines, boarded up clock towers, junk cars, and blazing drum barrel fires. What she saw in you, only her heart knows. Just like it knew you'd leave the temptress back at the listening booth, watching the automatic doors close behind you. At 16, you thought all there was to living was filling your appetite. Too young to know love is the everyday meal, that the lack of it kills quicker than the absence of food. That's it.
Wow. Food is one of your favorite words.
Yo, told you, man. I can't escape it.
You know, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work? What emerges from you?
Oh, can you say that one more time? I'm sorry.
Okay. They say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work?
Okay, so you mean like in terms of like themes or...
Who are you as a poet?
Okay. So and this is probably not going to be popular, but I kind of see the similarities between a poet and comedian, and not so much in the sense that the poet is trying to entertain people and make them laugh. I see it more so in the terms of process. So like a comedian will have their set down, and they will they will take that set to different open mics and do it over and over and over again until the set feels natural for them, till it feels like, you know, till the timing is right and they don't have to think about it. It's not even a thought. And in a lot of ways, that's how I kind of function. So, like, I'll take a poem that I just wrote, and, you know, I'll run it by Derek, run it by a small group of people, and, you know, they give me some good suggestions, and once I think I've gotten it to where it's okay to start taking it to the open mic, so start reading it at events and stuff, I will read that poem over and over and over again, like at different spots. And when I do that, I'm listening to the reaction from the audience. And that tells me if a poem is working or not. If I'm reading a poem and someone's laughing at a part that where I didn't mean for them to laugh, then that just tells me, okay, I may have to go back and do some work on the tone there, because something there is not conveying that it's not meant to be funny or whatever, you know, or maybe what, you know, maybe the tone, maybe there's something in there that's confusing the tone. But yeah, like and that's kind of where I look at, you know, where I see the similarities between a poet and comedian. And then also too, like, I kind of see like, and this was more for, I don't see this for like super, like uber successful poets doing this, but for like, you know, poets at like my level, you know, like I love getting stage time. And so when I get to stage time, it's not only an opportunity for exposure, but it's an opportunity for me to, you know, continue tweaking some pieces, or maybe I'm getting ready to feature somewhere and I want to try out, if I have enough time during the set, want to try out certain order of poems and see how it hits the audience before taking it into a set. So, you know, that's where the similarities between the poet and comedian comes from me.
Share another piece of your work, please.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this one is, I'll read this one. Looks like it's going to be the last poem, so I'll read this one. And earlier I had mentioned the cloud of judgment that I feel as a parent, so this poem deals with it. How it feels when your mother-in-law takes your daughter out of the crib after the crying, after you said she's not hungry because she threw up, after you told her your daughter rocks to sleep easy but cries when you put her back, when your child's grandmother takes her out after you told her not to, you remember the rose bush you and your wife chopped down, the one that blocked the living room window, that bullied away sunlight. And you know this grandmother's stubborn love for her grandchild gashes your authority, the way the thorny bush prickled your hand, arms, and legs, and its bold resistance, its open disregard for what you wanted. No one tells you parenting is like gardening, where you defend your choices from parasites posing as unwarranted advice, where insecurities bred by judgment and condescension can brown your confidence. When you watch your mother-in-law holding your child after you told her not to, you know how your wife felt that first night home from the hospital, when your parents came by and could only seem to unload their criticisms at how she handled her child, and if compassion's a deep sorrow for others' misfortune, do you forgive the know-it-all grandparents their transgressions, how they selectively forget their mistakes? Isn't humility an ingredient of compassion, the one that asked the grandparents to see themselves as they once were, green in their new role? You remember your parents fumbling in the dark of what they didn't understand, how the trial and error traumatized your childhood, how it pushed your brother into a homeless shelter and his mental illness, your brother spiraling in his orbit of pain, light years away from forgiveness. When your child's grandmother takes her out of her crib, you take your child back. Say, I love you, but I got this. Thank you.
What makes a poem good?
I think, for me, and
yes.
I was guilty of this, a lot of times my earlier works were anecdotal. They were anecdotes. And an older writer told me that. He said, yeah, you just write a bunch of anecdotes. And, you know, it bothered me when he said that, but when I looked back at it, it was, you know, I could look at it and say it's true that that's what they were. It was just a retelling or reliving of the event or whatever. But I think for me, the poems that I've come to love are the poems where the piece itself is not just it. It's not just the retelling, that there is a larger message, and that message, that the poem goes beyond itself. You know, so if I'm reading a poem and it's entertaining, but at the same time, the poem could make me think about things that maybe I experienced it, or maybe it makes me think or consider things that are going on in the world from another perspective. You know, for me, I think that poem is fulfilling. You know, it's done its job. You know, it's, you know, I feel like as the reader, if I'm, you know, when I enter someone's poem, I shouldn't leave it knowing what I knew before I went into the poem. I should feel changed in some sort of way. And so that's what I strive to do with my own work.
I know that you've written two books, Point Blank
mm-hmm.
and Drift. Are they both available on Amazon or other places?
Yep. So Point Blank and Drift are both available on Amazon, and Point Blank is also available as a Kindle, as an ebook. And I recently released Point Blank as the audiobook. So if you look them up on Amazon, you'll see the two editions there. But yeah, so for right now, those two books are the only books I've written.
Let me ask this question. If you had to convince a friend or a colleague to read Point Blank, what might you tell them?
I would ask them to look at the cover. And the cover is of a young man crossing the street with his earbuds in. And I would ask them, where do they think he's on his way to? And I would tell them, if they wanted to find out what's likely going through that young man's head, that they'd have to open up Point Blank to find out.
All right. I like that.
Thank you.
You know, we're closing in on the end of the hour, and
mm-hmm.
I can listen to your work forever because it's just incredible. It's great work.
Thank you.
You know,
when
people hear your work, I'm sure they usually want more. What's next for you as a poet?
Oh, you said what's next to me?
What's next for you as a poet?
Oh, next for
what's
me?
Next?
Oh, so after I did the audio book, and again, this was an experiment. It was I call it an experiment that Derek and I were working on. So after we recorded it and now it's on Audible, Derek has already gotten permission from his publisher to turn Wisdom Teeth into an audio book. So in terms of what's next, I'll be working with the D on, you know, helping him turn that into an audio book. And then I'm also a videographer. So when I'm not doing poetry, I'm caught up in the realm of video and audio. So that's it.
All right. Would you favor us with one more to close out the show?
Sure. So, Oh. All right. This poem is called The Journey, and it opens with a quote and an epigraph. Each day is a little life, every waking and rising a little birth, every fresh morning a little youth, every going to rest and sleep a little death. And that's a quote from author Schopenhauer. The poem is called The Journey. The dine is nearly empty when you both arrive, except for the six or so of the patrons and a waitress who calls everyone hun. The fluorescent lights lick the formica bar and chrome stools, the black and purple beaten booths, and a straw-headed boy staring at you over cold chicken strips, the ketchup a sticky scab on his plate. He reminds you of the little girls the night before, running through a restaurant in Berlin, Maryland, where you and your wife stayed at a hotel known to be an antique. Its hardwood bathroom floors, the claw-footed tub with its wraparound shower curtain, the portraits of hoop-skirted women twirling parasols, the prairie-style wooden armoire closets, the two girls laughing as they ran through the drummer's cafe, stopped at the sight of you and your wife, the only black people in the restaurant that night. When you remember the patrons darting eyes at your wife's dreadlocks, the way the hostess smiled past you to the white family she sat while you waited, when all around you the consensus seemed to echo the nursery rhyme, how did it get so late so soon, it's night before it's afternoon? You remember the loneliness of feeling like the only one fighting for sanity when the world makes you someone else. You watch your wife rub her full moon and talk to your daughter 27 weeks alive inside her, knowing that each day is a little life, each step towards progress, a little birth, even if the journey is full of off-ramps, like the one that brought you both to a bright diner on your way home, to the slurping straw that says the blonde boy savoring what's left of his chocolate shake before he sacks out on the plush seat, his mom flipping through a magazine picking at her fries. You watch him wrapped in his blue blanket as if sleep weren't a little death, as if the world weren't a dark dream haunted by a boogeyman's appetite for innocent things. Thank you.
Incredible. I'd like to thank you for sharing your amazing work with us tonight. And hopefully you'll return to the show and share more of your work.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. You know, honored to be in this space. So thank you for inviting me.
It's no problem. And to our listeners, take care. Until next week, we'll talk again. Have a good evening, everyone. Good night.